Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Underdog Fantasy is the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, the fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. You can play Pick'em, pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower total in each stat for this week's games for a chance to win big. You can actually win up to 100 times your money in a single night. That's right. I didn't say 10. I didn't say 20. Up to 100 times your money. Pick between 2 and 5 players. Build a Pick'em entry. My favorite feature, you can make rivals picks. Pit 2 players against each other. Wembanyama versus Nikola Jokic. Tim Hardaway Jr. versus Norm Powell. Kawhi Leonard versus Steph Curry. Who knows? Maybe Grayson Allen versus Pat Connaughton. You get where I'm going with that. You can do it all with Underdog Fantasy. Make sure you sign up today with the promo code DING. That's D-I-N-G. And get your first deposit doubled up to $100, as well as an instant Pick'em special. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our promo code DING, D-I-N-G, to get your first deposit doubled up to $100, as well as an instant Pick'em special. Must be 18 or older and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play? Call 1-800-522-4700 or visit www.ncpgambling.org.
Welcome back to another episode of Growing Up the Same. I'm your host, Trevon Edwards. I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Madison, and we have a special guest today, Brian Koppelman. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great. Thrilled to be here with you.
Welcome to the show, Brian. Brian Koppelman is an American showrunner. He's the co-writer of Ocean's 13 and Rounders, the producer for films like The Illusionist, The Lucky Ones, and the director for films like Solitary Man and the documentary This Is What They Want for ESPN as part of their 30 for 30 series, and the co-creator, showrunner, and executive producer of Showtime's Billions. Brian, this is the one of the two. Ready?
I'm ready. Go.
Writer or director?
Writer.
Savant or genius?
Refuse to answer.
Poker or blackjack?
Poker, which maybe makes me a genius.
Jay-Z or Biggie?
Jay-Z. I'm a huge Jay-Z fan.
LL Cool J or Rakim?
Well, So you have to understand, I grew up on Long Island, and I'm 54 years old. So I know the first two LL albums by heart, and when Don't Call It a Comeback came out with the guys playing behind him on the live thing, it was a big moment in my life. But I can't argue with Rakim's flow. It's a very difficult question to ask by my age in the world. But I have to, I think for loyalty purposes, I have to go with LL.
Nice. Led Zeppelin or Nirvana?
Led Zeppelin.
New York Dolls or the Smiths?
New York Dolls. That's a great question. New York Dolls. But REM over either of those.
Nice.
And Velvet Underground over either of those.
Beatles or Stones?
Stones.
CD or vinyl?
Vinyl.
DVD or Laserdisc?
Oh, Laserdisc, because of all the additional material that they would put on Laserdiscs.
I used to love Laserdisc.
Oh, I loved them. I don't have them anymore, and I don't really have much vinyl either, but yeah.
Ed Norton or John Malkovich?
You're talking about two guys I've been friends with and worked with for 22 years. There's zero chance of answering that one. I love them both.
Ocean's 11 or 12?
That's funny, 11.
The Killing or Small Time Crooks?
Oh, the Killing is just incredible. I mean, every version of The Killing is incredible, The Killing.
Yeah, I was talking about Kubrick's original.
Yeah, Kubrick's version is just insane. Sterling Hayden is amazing in that movie. I mean, I watched it very recently. And again, I've watched it so many times. That's a seminal movie.
Leaving Las Vegas or Misery?
The Book of Misery.
Mississippi Grind or Cincinnati Kid?
Mississippi Grind.
Michael Douglas or Matt Damon?
Again, I mean, there's just zero. I mean, literally, you're talking about people who I've, you know, and it's not good. Listen, asking about movie stars is I understand the question, but, and it also sounds absurd to be like, these are my friends, but you know, I've known Matt. Matt put me on the map. Dave and I, our first script was Rounders that Matt starred in, and Michael starred in a movie I wrote that we directed called Solitary Man. And they're both great. And I'd say those two dudes love each other too. They did that Liberace movie together, and they're great friends. They're both, those two people are two of the kindest, most loyal people in the whole business, Matt and Michael. They really are. It's an honor to know both of them.
I had the good fortune of meeting Matt Damon last year and had a real good conversation with him. He's a super cool guy.
Yeah, he has the ability to be super down to earth despite the place in the world in which he lives, you know?
Exactly. Wes Anderson or David Lynch?
David Lynch changed my life because I practice transcendental meditation, and I meditate every day, twice a day. But as a filmmaker, I prefer Wes Anderson.
Oliver Stone or Mike Nichols?
Geniuses, both geniuses. Oliver Stone is a huge influence on me. I think Oliver Stone, his like personal behavior may be highly questionable, but Oliver Stone is an artist. I don't think I'd do what I do necessarily without Platoon, Wall Street, the script for Scarface, Midnight Express. I mean, as a dialogue writer.
Camera blocking or camera angle?
Blocking.
Brooklyn or Manhattan?
Manhattan. Except I think I'm switching my allegiance to the Nets after 50 years of fandom. Yeah.
Penthouse or beach house?
In this environment, beach house.
Axe or Rhodes?
Come on. Next question.
Phil Hellmuth or Johnny Chan?
Oh, great one. I mean, I think you have to go with the Rounders loyalty, but I'm much closer. I mean, Phil's been in two things of mine, Tilt and Billions. Johnny helped put us on the map like Matt. I'm friends with Phil to some extent, or very friendly with Phil, and Johnny, I don't know at all. But I think I got to go with Johnny.
All right. Power or money?
Power.
Yeah. Free speech or free will?
Free speech.
Siskel or Ebert?
Ebert.
Knicks or Yankees?
Knicks. Knicks for life. Knicks till I die. Misery, though. But it's horrible. It's a horrible thing to have to say. I'm really trying to switch to the Nets.
Yeah. Steve Bannon or Stephen Miller?
Ha! That's awesome. Stephen Miller is like the guy who opens the oven so the other guy can shove him in the oven, you know?
Yeah.
So I think they're both terrible, horrible. But Bannon is like an evil, sick, twisted genius, and Miller is just a toady.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy or Richard Pryor?
Eddie Murphy.
George Carlin or Robin Williams?
You're really good at this, Jason.
Thank you.
You're great at this. Robin.
Kurt Vonnegut or J.D. Salinger?
J.D. Salinger made me, like, partially who I am. So, I mean, Vonnegut, for today, right now, like, if you're listening to this, wondering who to dive into, go read Vonnegut. But for my life, over the course of my life, Salinger.
TV or film?
TV.
The Departed or Wolf of Wall Street?
Wolf.
Would you rather ride by yourself or ride in a team?
I love riding with David.
Would you rather time travel or stop time?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. Do you ask that one every time?
No. Most of these are always original, but depending on the guest.
No, I can tell on all the other ones.
Yeah.
Could be. Time travel.
Nice. Would you rather have a great paying job that you love or a low paying job that you hate? The inverse.
I mean, that's an easy answer. Great paying job that I love.
Or low paying job that you love. That was my bad.
I view myself as someone who also is able to protect and provide. So I would suck it up, but I would keep trying to find the thing that I love. And I did. I mean, I turned my life inside out a bunch of times to find something that I loved. I do think that in our culture, if you can amass some resources, it's helpful.
Yeah, agreed. Italian food or Chinese food?
So because people look to me for this exact thing you just asked, I will say, I don't know that you can be, I am not somebody who's actually able to be successful at something I don't love. That's why I had to turn, I can't live those days.
Yeah.
But your question presupposes that you can't turn the thing you love into something high that will be rewarding. I think in the real world, you can. In the real world, if you love it enough and give enough to it, you can make a foundation to your life maybe. So that's the more complete answer.
Right. Italian food or Chinese food?
Chinese.
Lucali's or Roberta's?
Roberta's.
Nathan's or Sabret's?
Nathan's.
Robots or aliens?
Aliens.
And the last one, gambling or the stock market?
Oh, gambling. Please. It's like saying gambling or gambling.
Right. Well, that was the one of the two. Thank you.
That was great. That's excellent. Great work.
So I don't have a fun segment like Jason does. I always normally either dive really deep or we kind of pick up to the fun part, but it's not just as fun as his part. But we discussed three topics that you wanted to talk about in your childhood or just adolescence. We'll start with,
you should know that I do not remember what I said.
Okay. So yeah, so it might
whatever you ask me is going to be fine.
Okay. So, how does ADHD affect you? During your childhood, for one, and then we can probably get to now.
Oh, it affected me so much. First of all, when I was a kid, and I love talking about this because someone out there listening has a relative or they themselves can't figure out why their performance is so uneven. Why when they love something, they're excited about it, they can perform at a high level. But if they don't, they actually do such a bad job that everyone around them thinks they're lazy or stupid. And I was lucky enough that I had parents who told me I was smart, though at times they thought lazy maybe. But they over and over told me that I was smart enough to be doing better if I applied myself. That said, school was incredibly painful. The things that compelled me, I could do well at. I taught myself to speed read because I loved reading, you know, kids' novels, kids' books when I was like in fourth grade. And before that, I had no reason to care about it. So I had a huge vocabulary, but I didn't read. Then my mom gave me a book that I liked. I was like, oh, this is great. And then I went crazy reading. But if someone gave me a history book to read, I was unable to do it. It would be like the book was toxic. Like it was almost like it was radioactive and it was pushing me away. Like the ions were just making it that I could not approach the book. I would just sit there and listen to records all night long. And instead of doing my homework, knowing I should do my homework, and I wouldn't be able to. And nobody understood ADHD then. There were no medicines really. You only got Ritalin if you were incredibly hyperactive. I was a disruption sometimes in class for being a wise ass, but I wasn't bouncing off the walls in that way. I was just, I could, boredom killed me. Anything that was boring, I just couldn't do it. And yet it made me a disciplinary problem because I'd be sitting in class reading the book I wanted to read. If the teacher wasn't keeping my attention, I would start entertaining the whole class. And so I got a lot of detentions. I had a lot of problems in school. I constantly felt this huge gap between what I felt like my potential might be and what my achievements were. And that gap can really crush you. And it tortured me, you know, to look at my friends who I could keep up with in conversation. I could read 10 books to their 2 books and talk about them if it was something I was interested in. But I couldn't do what seemed simple to them, seemed impossible to me. And it would manifest in other ways too. You know, like I was an athlete. I played sports. I was a varsity at 2 varsity sports. But like inevitably there would be some issue with the coach or I would be distracted. You know, I'd be in playing tennis and I would get distracted by something. And so learning how to manage that, recognizing it. Also, nobody told me what it was. So I was just walking around thinking, for some reason, I'm a failure. You know, I can't get good grades. I was always able to do outside stuff. So I was like producing records when I was a kid and I was promoting concerts. And I was able to like get myself into a good college because I was able to write a good essay and do some stuff. But every second of it was torture. And college too. College, I succeeded at all sorts of outside stuff, but I had a bad GPA. And I was, even at college, it still kind of haunted me. It wasn't until I was much older and started going to therapy that I realized what was going on. I read some books about it and realized, okay, well, I hit 30 out of 30 of these questions when they ask you the question, you know, the questionnaire. And so I realized, all right, well, I got to figure out how do people manage this? You know, what do people do to deal with it? And so I've gone on Adderall, Vyvanse, all that stuff. I'm not taking any of it now. Because for me, I was able to, once I was on that stuff, for the most part, I was able to afterwards sort of mimic the behaviors of it, largely. I'm not against that stuff. I would take Adderall if I felt I was going into a period where I needed it to do a lot of hard work over an extended period of time. I might take it, but I haven't taken it in probably 2 years. I'll go 2 years not taking it, 6 months taking it to kind of remind myself. It made me, the ADHD and the sort of reaction from schools really did make me wonder whether I'd able, part of me knew I'd be able to be successful because I saw in certain ways I could achieve things. But another part of me was constantly haunted by, well, what if you are lazy? What if you can't do it? What if you'll always not finish things? And what if you'll always be somebody who just comes up short? And so that really haunted me for a long time. And I'll say, I always say this. I just, you know, I love the premise of the podcast. And I had huge advantages. You know, I've thought about this a lot. Like a kid who wasn't raised the way I was with privilege. My dad had some money. I knew college would be paid for. I knew how to talk to people in power so that when they were going to throw me out, because I watched my father do it. So when they were going to throw me out of somewhere, I knew how to charm them. I knew how to relate to them. As a man, I knew how to talk about sports with people, which is a very powerful thing to be able to do. As a white man, and a white kid even, I was able to make my misbehavior just look sort of charming, like Ferris Bueller. And so there are all these ways that I think I was resourceful, so I have to give myself some credit. But I also know that the situation was built, as painful as it was for me, it was built with some kind of a floor that I couldn't crash below. And that I was hugely advantaged. Two parents, enough money, private schools when I needed to be in a private school, and a lot of second chances that a lot of people don't get. And that all that stuff happened to me. And, you know, they would try to find a tutor who could help me. Even though they got it wrong, like no tutor knew what was going on, there were like constant attempts to remedy what was happening. So I had, as painful as it was still, I'm aware, so much better than it is for many people. There were so many opportunities where somebody else would have just fallen through the cracks, been labeled a behavioral problem. I mean, I was. They wanted to throw me out a bunch, but they labeled it in a way that was permanent, that would have gone on their record and would have screwed them up. And that was just never in the cards for me.
Thank you for sharing that. All right, our next topic would be, how has suicide of a close friend of yours affected you mentally and in your life?
Yeah, when I was 12, one of my very closest friends killed himself, which is the kind of thing that we'd known each other from the age of four. We both had the same first name. When you're four, that's a big bonding thing. And we spent a ton of time together from ages four to like 11. He got a little more distant in the last year before his death, but we were still super close. I wasn't at his house as much. We used to be at each other's houses constantly. And I think the year that he died, maybe we were slightly less at each other's houses, though in constant communication and at school together. But it made me aware almost instantly, I will say, I changed like that. Almost instantly, I started holding those close to me closer. You know, I reacted, I guess you can react in a couple ways. One is like, well, fuck it, I'm never putting myself at risk again of having a close relationship. But I clicked into a gear where, like, if you were my friend now, I had to know that you were okay. And I had to be there to try, you know, as much out of neurosis as out of having a good heart or whatever. But it taught me, like, the fact that suddenly he was gone, the permanence of that at 12 is a really heavy thing. You know, I don't know if either of you have lived through losing someone young, but when you do, it does shift your belief system in some way. The permanence of it, the vacuum that's there, the self-recrimination, you know, wondering what you could have done. You go through all these stages. But his death and a couple of other deaths along the way reaffirmed to me, like, the thing we talked about earlier of being fully engaged in stuff. Life is fucking short, as much of a cliche as that is. And hold the people dear to you dear. Check in with them. I'm big on that. I'm big on checking in. I'm big on making sure you're okay. I'm big on, if I'm in a car, I try to think, who could I call who I haven't reached out to in a while? And as you get older now, you know, in my 50s, I've lost in the last 3 years, like, three real friends and people who would be those recipient of those phone calls from the car. And I'm really walking around aware now that this thing is fast, and the only meaning is the meaning you give it. And that meaning often comes from your relationships with those that you love, your friends and your family, and work that you love, and being engaged in stuff that you love. And I think I started thinking about all that stuff when Brian died, when we were in seventh grade.
Yeah, I can relate a little bit as far as, but the thing was, is that the association of it, and it's kind of similar to like how you, no one had an answer for you for ADHD. Growing up in Compton, normally people that needed someone to talk to or anything like that, therapy was kind of frowned upon. So those individuals were normally lost. And then especially me growing up in a heavy gang community, it was just kind of like they were kind of castaways, you know, in that scenario. And, you know, obviously myself experiencing death with my father early on and then not having my mother around and just seeing death all the time, I became desensitized to it. You know what I mean? And like now at 35, I feel the same way you feel as far as like how important relationships mean in that aspect. But it was a big empty time for roughly almost 15 years where it's just kind of, I'm getting phone calls, I'm getting, you know, this person took their life or this person died. And it just became, you know, if I'm getting a certain phone call after 9 p.m., I already knew what it was, you know, and that, and it's unfair for that. But like funerals, it's to a point, I think our last guest we had on was talking about the struggling of like just being able to cry. Like I haven't cried in roughly a decade. So I envy the people that are able to do that. But like your awareness early on to have that, I wish I could have had sooner, you know, just to kind of appreciate a person's life a little bit more versus like the product of an environment situation. Because it was like, well, I hate the term the game's the game, but that's kind of how it felt, you know, like, well, that's how life is. And I didn't like that because now it just makes it seem like this is just how it's supposed to go. And you think that some people are supposed to live forever. Like we're getting these now, these news death alerts about people dying and have an old age, and you're like, well, they lived a full life. And those people in your head, you're like, oh, okay, you don't picture that you're getting older as well, you know.
Yes.
And then also with the younger people, it's just kind of like, you know, I got in a car accident, I could have lost my life 3 weeks ago, and I think about that. So my mental approach every day has been different, you know what I mean? Whether I'm getting off the phone telling somebody I love them or whatever, I'm still working on the feel part. I don't have the feel. And I think that's the thing that I daily struggle with sometimes, just because I want to feel and I don't know how to. So
do you do some kind of therapy now?
I do. And then I also host a trauma group, you know, where I'm talking to other individuals to help them cope with the situation. So it's been very helpful. But man, thank you so much for sharing that, because I related to that so much.
I didn't cry for a long time either. Now I can cry at movies. And do you meditate?
I do. I actually, it was Wilson Chandler from the Brooklyn Nets actually introduced me when quarantine. I had a lot of time to sit with myself, and he was just like, yo, I got this yogi. So it was like yoga plus meditation. And right. It's been super helpful, but since I broke my leg,
that helps lock in.
Mm-hmm.
Even transcendental meditation, which is what I do, which I'm happy to hook you up.
Yeah, please share. I'm definitely interested in that.
Catching the Big Fish by David Lynch, and it's Lynch's book about how meditation helped him, the particular kind. And check that book out. The audiobook is the best.
Okay.
His voice is so strange. The audiobook is amazing, Catching the Big Fish by David Lynch. And if you dig it, let me know and I can help sort you out and get a talk. Because meditation helps to get in touch with that part of yourself that you had to lock off when you were a kid, because otherwise you'd be crying and screaming. You wouldn't be crying.
Yeah.
You'd be screaming, wailing and having to turn yourself inside out every 5 minutes because – of the environment in which you were raised and or which you were not raised, you know, you were growing, you had to raise yourself at a certain point. And for me, like movies would, even life wouldn't make me cry, but movies would. And then I found a way to like tap back in so that I can be affected in life. But I understand that desire to be able to cry. I once almost wrote a movie about someone. Maybe I still am gonna.
I was going to say go for it, because I would like that. I like to find movies that I'm relatable to.
The first scene, they can't cry. I had a whole thing I wrote about it, that they can't cry. And it bothers them that they can't cry. They're shut down for this reason. And they were like a war doctor in the thing I had written about. But it's a real thing. I get it. It's a real thing.
And see, I'm kind of the opposite And I have actually like a story that's relatable to both of you guys. So like the first tattoo I got was at the beginning of this year is for my cousin who was murdered, Alex. Alex,
I'm so sorry.
And basically when I was 20, I was in college, you know, he was trying to be a blood and, you know, he got murdered in front of a Ralph's, you know what I'm saying, in Inglewood. And it was just, it's still hard for me to deal with, you know what I'm saying? But it motivated me in such a way, you know, like basically my cousin is a rapper. We were working on music. I was producing music for him. And it's actually kind of what turned me into a director, producer and all that, because I was basically like, I had a realization of how precious my life was. Like my cousin was the same age as me, you know what I'm saying? And to see him gone, it was just like, I couldn't believe it. You know what I'm saying?
There was just no talking to him. Like you knew he was doing, living that life.
Yeah. And it was like, it was like one of those things where, you know, you're 19, 20 years old, everybody, I'm in college, he's off doing that. You know, you kind of had that little fork in the road towards high school. And like, you know, I basically took all that energy and put it into my other cousin, like, yo, you have to make it as a rapper. We have to make it, you know, doing whatever we're doing, because life is, like you said, life is short. We don't know what's going to happen. And it's, you know, and so whenever I talk about it, still, I get choked up. I still have a lot of emotions behind it because I am one of those people who cries a lot and I'm able to cry a lot.
You know? Better, though. That's better. You think?
Yeah.
It's better. Trey, it's better.
Right? Yeah. Nah. Better. Like I said, I envy those people for sure. Definitely. You know, and people are like, why? Why would you want to? And I'm just like, it's just certain situations because you come off so cold or not dark in that scenario because you actually try to feel something, but you just can't, you know? And I think it's the most awkward thing. Yeah, it's the most awkward thing ever when, you know, someone's telling you or sharing bad news with you and you're just kind of like, well, it's kind of like taking a picture and not knowing to do with your hands. You know, that's pretty much what it is for me. My next question on a transition on to tell us about your junior year and making the big decision of playing varsity ball or directing a play.
Well, yeah. So it was a good fork in the road kind of a thing. As you were just saying, fork in the road. I was really interested in both things. You know, growing up, there was nothing for most of my early life. Nothing was more important to me than basketball. I wasn't great at basketball, but I was a really good like 8-year-old basketball player. And then when everyone got physically better, it became harder. You know, like I just wasn't a gifted athlete in that way. But I was like, I loved it. The Knicks were the most important thing in the world to me. I played basketball every single day. All I did, it came from school. I just played basketball. You know, and I in 10th grade, I didn't make varsity. I made JV. Coach and I did not get along. But in 11th grade, I made the varsity, which is a big deal. And I knew I wouldn't play a lot, but I made the team, which really mattered to me. And I really wanted the jacket and I really wanted to be in the layup line. I mean, you know, I just wanted to be in that layup line. But right then I got offered every year in our school, there was a musical put on by the junior class and the faculty picked one kid who got to direct the show, and I got picked to direct the show. But you couldn't play ball if you directed the show. And if you would have asked me 6 months, like, I never thought I'd do this for my life. I never thought I'd be somebody telling stories and making stuff. I mean, that all didn't happen for me for 10 more years. But when I looked at it, I remember talking to the coach who I really liked, and he said, there is no guarantee. I said to him, if I go do the play, can I play varsity senior year? And he's like, well, I can't guarantee it because, as you know, the whole point of someone making a team in 11th grade is that they understand what it's like to be on varsity. They get in my system and then maybe they can play senior year. Bringing on a senior who's not one of the best players, it doesn't really do me anything, the coach was saying to me. Like, I'd much rather pull up a 10th or 11th grader and let them be on varsity so that by the time they're seniors, they can contribute, you know. So, but I thought about it a lot. And I guess something in me must have known that the opportunity to direct a play, a musical, and be a part of that would give me something more, would connect me, you know, that was an opportunity to talk to actors, meaning to have to talk to an actor about their performance, even though I'm sure I did it in a terror at, you know, 15 or 16 years old, I wasn't probably great at it, but just getting the reps in of putting on a show and talking to actors and staging, blocking them on stage, you know, learning, it turned out to be the better decision. And then senior year, and so I got to do the play, which was really a great thing. And it was great that I followed my instinct. I mean, nobody was telling me to do the play except the drama guy. And nobody expected that I would do that because even though I had done all the plays, like I was in all the plays and assistant direct, all that shit. But everybody thought like my identity was so tied to basketball in every way, in amongst my friend group and amongst like my family, you know, but I just had to do it. And then I remember senior year going to tryouts and the coach was great. He pulled me aside. This guy, he'd been a great college player, actually famous when he was much older than me, but famous when he was in college. But he pulled me aside and he said, here's the thing. You can make the team, like, but you're going to be like, you're good enough to make the team. I can't cut you on merit, but you have to know you're really not going to play. Like you're going to be the 11th or 12th man. I want you in the, he goes, I want you on the bus because like, you're going to keep people loose. You're a good teammate. You're fun to have around, but you got to know you can't sulk because you're really not going to play. Like you're just not going to play very much. So decide. And then I did it. I played senior year and I'm so glad that I played senior year, you know? And I mean, I was the kid, the whole gym was screaming to put me in when there were 4 minutes left and all that shit. And as soon as I would touch the ball, I would fucking launch it. So my name would get in the newspaper. Like I was the ridiculous, but you know, it was like, getting to do both things, to direct that play and then actually getting to play, on the varsity meant something to me as a kid. And it's something that I always have, you know, that I did that.
Man, yeah, that's a good experience. Now the listeners will know that, you know, Brian Koppelman played varsity basketball. That's higher than some of the people that troll people on Twitter. So
well, like I said, I was there, but I also admitted I was the 11th man on the team. I mean, I didn't I got in games, but not when anything was on the line.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, it's all good.
I
man.
Actually got much better in I got much better at basketball. My body caught up. I became much better like my junior year of college. Not good enough to play college ball, but like I played every single day in college and then suddenly like, oh, this game really made sense to me, but it was fucking too late. It was just too late.
Yeah, I mean, it normally clicks like that. The more and more you play, your IQ expands and, you know, you work smarter than harder. So, you know, you see the game a little bit different.
Just learning how to run the, like really learning where to, you know, all that shit that they try to tell you. Mm-hmm. It's hard when you're, I don't, you know, that aspect of it, especially if you're not very physically gifted. You know, really knowing how to fill the lanes, really understanding how to pick up your dribble and drive, like all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to me when I got older.
What's your favorite childhood memory?
Favorite childhood memory? Yeah. It's so corny, but it is true. And it's a thing I took parenting-wise. Do either of you guys have kids?
No kids. Not yet.
I had one big rule that I made as a parent because my dad had it, which was whenever my son in this case, but it could have been either of them. Whenever my son wanted to have a baseball catch, I would always say yes. And I was like, that was just my rule. Like, I thought if you just always say yes to a baseball catch, it means you're always going to say yes to lots of stuff. But also there's something about throwing a baseball with your dad that is a very important thing. And my dad and he pitched in the Coast Guard. And he's 80 now, but he and I, he would come home from work, he'd be tired, whatever. And if I was like, threw him the baseball glove or threw him a basketball, didn't matter. He was a good shooter at hoops, but having like long baseball catches and just with my dad and just either talking or being silent, that would be about as good as it got for me growing up.
Did you sneak that in billions?
I don't know if we put the rule in there. I told a friend of mine about it recently.
Because I saw that, and I was just like, But
maybe I did. Did I put it in the show?
Yeah, they were just making a pitch, like, you know, just kind of just tossing the ball. But I just was like,
Sure, yeah. But I don't think I said the thing where you got a
pitch. No. You didn't have it in there, but, like, now it just kind of struck to me, like, okay.
Oh, yeah. David and I always put tons of stuff from our lives in the show.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, my last question, and then Jason has a few. What's been the happiest you've been in your professional career?
Billions, this now. Not right now, obviously, during COVID, but, you know, global pandemic's not a great time for anybody, and we're not shooting the show now. But getting to work with that group of actors, you know, with my lifelong best friend who I create with, and having people react to the show the way they do. You know, we get to make exactly the show we want. We put exactly what we want in the show. We don't hold back ever at all. And people who love the show are fanatics. And so it's just an amazing thing. And my wife's happy and healthy, and my kids are happy and healthy. And that's, like, you know, for me, the most important thing. And so overall, this has been a very sort of sweet spot.
Going on the
bench. Well, I should say one thing, which was at 49. It is important for your listeners, because at 49 around, I had an incredible low point. We had a movie called Runner Runner that came out and bombed. We were going to run a TV show and got fired. And our agent basically told us we were not employable. We were unemployable. So I was 49. I had done this for like 19 or 20 years. And suddenly was told that it was unclear if I would have any professional possibilities. And I remember talking to my wife about maybe selling our apartment so that, you know, we could make sure we could pay for college and all that stuff. And out of that, Dave and I wrote the pilot for Billions and with Andrew, and we wrote the pilot for Billions and changed our lives. And so I was at a real low point of 49, and now I'm 54. And I can tell you the last 5 years have been far and away the best professionally. You know, unless I really screw it up, I'm never gonna have to sell my apartment. And I figured the whole, you know, I was able to sort of like get myself to a place professionally that, that I'd always wanted to get to. And that's late in life. You know, a lot of people think 35, 40, 45, it's too late. But I literally was 49 and told, give it up, and didn't give it up, and was able then to literally, you know, put myself, Dave and I were put ourselves in a whole new category.
So are Bobby Axelrod or Chuck Rhodes based on any real life people?
They're not. They're composite characters, really. You know, we interview a lot of people. We went to a lot of hedge funds, spoke to a lot of managers of hedge funds, spoke to a lot of lawyers, thought about it, read a lot, and that's where they came from. People guess, and I don't mind people guessing. I like it, but they're not based on real people.
What gave you the confidence to write a character like Asia Kate Dillon's Taylor Mason into a script on a show like Billions that, you know, deals with so many other heteronormative topics, and, you know, including a non-binary person into that dynamic?
Both of my kids came home from, one was at college, one was at high school. Within like 2 weeks of each other, they told me a story of other kids telling their pronouns. And I'd never heard of it. Being an older, you know, like older person, I was like, what do you mean they're telling their pronouns? And then I got the lecture from both of them. But let me explain. This is what it is. So hearing about that was, I brought it to the writer's room and I said, people are now saying their pronouns and here's why. And there are some people who don't identify as either gender. And then another writer in the writer's room said he had just met somebody like that. And we started researching it and we realized, oh, there's a way to make this character remind acts of himself, but on the externally, they could be an entirely different kind of person. So you watching the show would have no idea that this is the person who might be Axe's protege. And so then we interviewed non-binary people, read a lot about, like, we did the work to do it correctly. And then we were lucky that we cast Asia Kate Dillon, you know?
Yeah, they are great in the role. And it's an amazing thing to see them in that performance for the world, you know? And I enjoy it as somebody who, you know, enjoys everybody. And like, I work in like production, post-production, whatever. And I like worked on Pose when they first started. And I was like, this is cool. Like, there's finally all the representation that everybody's been talking about is finally emerging in media. And I love to see it.
Yes. It's been that part of it. I don't think Dave and I were sure, neither was Asia, how people would react. But like every day you see evidence of how that character has had a positive influence, and it's awesome. I mean, to think that a show like ours would have something in it that's that nutrient rich for the world is really great.
Yeah. How did you and Eddie Murphy strike up a friendship?
friendship overstates it, but I mean, I love him. We're not friends. So if I think if I saw him and I told him who I was, he would be cool. I haven't seen him in 30 years. I was managing, when I was a kid, I did a lot of stuff outside of school. And one of those things was I was managing a folk singer and he played at a club. And this is when Eddie was a featured player the first year he was on the show. And I got this kid a gig opening for Eddie, and the kid he was a white Jewish folk singer, and he got booed off the stage, no fault of his. The audience was there to see Eddie Murphy. It was a Long Island audience that was there to see Eddie, his people from, you know, because he grew up there. So it was like, just nobody had any time for this kid. But I hung around and watched Eddie, and it was like nothing I'd ever seen in my life. It was the single best, you know, 2 hours of comedy, and he just pulled, it was just insane. So I snuck backstage and introduced myself to him and his manager, and I was like, you should be making records. And my father was in that business, and I connected them and got the album to happen. And so, like, my dad made those albums with Eddie, the Eddie Murphy comedian, and he partied, you know, My Girl Wants to Party All the Time, all that shit. So I was just around him, and he was super sweet to me as a kid. I guess I'm 4 years younger or something like that. And he was just super nice to me the whole time. He was, and he and my dad, as people do, had a business falling out, and, or really his manager, my dad did, but there was a big business falling out, and I hadn't seen or heard from Eddie in a long time. And I was standing in LA 5 years later, maybe. He was Eddie Murphy by this point, as big a star as you could be. And I was standing in this line, and I saw there was Eddie walking with a group of people. And I was with, I think, one friend and I think maybe a girl. And I saw him and I was like, Eddie, hey, Brian Koppelman. And he just fucking breezed past me. It was and just like coldly, just barely acknowledged and moved. And then a minute later, he tapped me on the shoulder. And he's like, hey, man, I couldn't just walk past. And he gave me a hug and it was super sweet and like, great. And it was awesome. He's like, yeah, whatever with your pop has nothing to do with you and whatever. It was great. Yeah. And that's like the last, I think I saw him one other time. And it meant a lot to me when I was a kid.
Yeah. What's your feeling on film school and its necessity to become as successful as a filmmaker or somebody who just works in the industry?
I mean, Quentin Tarantino didn't go and PTA left, right? So, and they might be the two, you know, two of the very best people. I think it's all individual stuff. You know, I've always been fairly skeptical about which parts could be taught. That said, knowing how to light, knowing how to edit, knowing the basics, if you can afford the time, if you can afford the money and the time in your life to go do that, I think there's very little negative. If you have an idea for a movie, I mean, look, Spike Lee obviously made We Cut Heads and began writing She's Gotta Have It. So like if you can take the time, it's worth taking the time. I never did it. There were times standing on the set of my first movie I really wished I had. Now it doesn't matter. You know, now all these years later, like I've learned, but it wouldn't have been bad to go in knowing what different lenses look like.
Right.
All right, my last question that we ask every guest on the show is, what advice would you give 18-year-old Brian?
Don't worry so much about the people who don't understand who you are and what your intentions are and what your dreams are. There are always going to be people scared of people with big dreams, always going to be people threatened by people who see the world differently. And know that. Do your own work every day. Write something every single day. And don't let the haters win.
Thank you so much, Brian, for joining us. This has been another episode of Growing Up the Same.